As the school year draws to a close and a new crop of students heads off to college this fall, the age-old challenge of paying for it is on the minds of many. But this year, another group is taking up that challenge: Congress, and the president, too. I'm Brian Ellison. Today on Central Standard, we'll talk with members of Congress Mike Pompeo of Kansas and Emmanuel Cleaver of Missouri about their competing visions for how to help a new generation of Americans borrow for school and eventually pay it back. Then later, we'll offer some help, some practical guidance on how best to save and prepare for the day when your children head off to school. Investment professionals and financial aid experts will offer tips and take your questions. That's all ahead on Central Standard after the news. Let's say you're a college sophomore without a lot of cash. When you headed off to school last fall, you were able to borrow money to pay for it. Your interest rate, 3.4%, subsidized by the federal government. Well, I hope you're enjoying your summer vacation, because when you go back to school next fall, your interest rate on new loans is going to double to 6.8%. The same classes will cost you thousands more to pay for down the road, unless, that is, our leaders in Washington do something about it. This is Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Today we're talking about the effort in Congress this month to do something before July 1st to keep that from happening. Everyone seems to agree something must be done, but the president, the House Republicans, the Senate Democrats, they all have different ideas about what that should be. Later in the program, we'll talk about some practical help for parents and students, regardless of what happens this month in Congress. But first, we're zeroing in on that debate. We'll be joined in a few minutes by Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver, Democrat of Kansas City. But first, KCUR's Matthew Long Middleton spoke yesterday with Congressman Mike Pompeo, a Republican from the Wichita area, about his support for his party's plan.
Congressman Mike Pompeo, welcome to Central Standard.
It's great to be with you, Matt. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. House Bill 1911 is really an amendment to the Higher Education Act of 1965. What exactly did this bill change?
Well, it changed a couple of things. It's a little important to know the history. And so what the bill did is it took the student loans rate, which are scheduled for most student loan programs, and the Perkins is an exception, but most student loans are set to revert to a 6.8% interest rate on July 1st of this year, so now less than 30 days out. And this has gone back and forth throughout time. We've had with different politicians at different times trying to set these rates. And what the House did in H.R. 1911 is it tried to say, look, we're going to try and get the political process out of the middle of setting these rates every year or every couple years, voting in a highly contentious way about what the right interest rate is. And so it took a different approach. It says, look, we're going to continue to provide these student loans. We're going to continue to provide them at a rate that we think is affordable for students who are trying to get to school, but we're going to set it to market forces, fixing what the Congress before I was actually here, this would have been back in 2006 when Speaker Pelosi was running the House of Representatives, where they set this 6.8% rate starting July 1st. I think that's too high for where market conditions are today, so we're working to fix that and set these rates or tie these rates to market moving forward.
So two follow-up questions there. What is the interest rate roughly now?
Yeah, so it is today 3.4% and will go to 6.8%, so an actual doubling in the next 30 days.
Unless this bill that you folks passed in the House gets made into law.
That's correct.
And I get that would be my second follow-up question. So what would be, you said market forces, but that's a little ambiguous to me.
You bet. I'll be a little more specific. So it takes both the Stafford subsidized and unsubsidized loans and takes them to the 10-year Treasury note plus 2.5%. And there's a cap. And today that would be well under that 6.8%.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I read it would be a max rate of, I think, something like
of 8.5%.
Of 8.5%.
That's right. So it has a cap should Treasury rates rise to 6% or greater, which were 10-year Treasury rates, rather, to 6% or greater, which we're an awful long way from today. But they've been there historically, so it's possible they could get back there. But this is an effort to get out of every year fighting about what the right interest rate is and try and make sure we're charging students consistent with economic condition.
And so is that why you voted for this bill?
It is. It is. It's So I voted last year for a one-year extension at the current rate. We sit here and argue about what the right rate is, and it sounds like it happened before I was here in Congress as well. We ought not do that. It creates uncertainty for students and for schools and for student aid officers at the schools, all the folks involved in that process. So this would give them the ability to know, hey, this is how it's going to be set. This is going to be a long-term solution. We don't have to wait and see what Congress is going to do every year or every other year.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think about the fact that 60% of college students take out loans to finance their higher education. And gross higher education debt is, you know, anywhere between $900 billion and $1 trillion, according to the Fed Reserve in New York and the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. And I've heard that, you know, some opponents of this bill are concerned it might make the cost of college and higher education more expensive. So how do you respond to that concern?
Man, it's a concern that I've heard raised as well. But, Matt, in the short run, it actually reduces the cost for students. Absent this becoming law, student loan rates go back up to 6.8% literally weeks from now. And so certainly the immediate effect of this bill becoming law would be to reduce the cost of education. But two thoughts, I think, are worthy of note there. I've read a great deal about the sort of the history of the student loan program and the financing of higher education. And one of the things that I can say from personal experience, having a son that just graduated from Kansas University myself, literally weeks ago now, is that the cost of higher education has greatly, the increases in cost of higher education have greatly outpaced the inflation rate over the last decade or two. And that's something that is simply not sustainable. And so we're hoping, too, that this will set a course where those folks putting together programs at schools and trying to allocate costs for tuition and for teacher salaries, professor salaries, and all of those things will have the stability they need to try and be efficient in the way they deliver education. And it'll help students make good choices about the school that they want to go to. Where do they think they're going to get good value for the money they spend, whether they spend that money that is their own, or money that their parents are helping them with, or whether it's money that they actually borrow as part of the process of paying for their education.
And, I want to follow up on that. There is another part of this bill, 1911, which deals with a little bit into that. Like it calls for an investigation into post-secondary education transparency. And I think you just hit upon some of that. But could you go into a little bit more detail about what you're hoping to uncover with this investigation and committee?
So this is the second point. Investigation is one term. I think it's just really more of an idea of transparency. It's the idea that students ought to have the capacity to know where their money is going, what it's being used for, how it's being allocated, whether that's to actual classroom instruction or to other things that the school is doing, extracurricular activities, professors, all of those things that go into building an education at an institution. Different colleges choose to do them differently. Butler County Community College will choose to do it differently than folks in Pratt or in Johnson County Community College or at our four-year institutions, all of these different places that students have available to them to continue their schooling after K through 12. This will give them a little more ability to decide, hey, this is what I'm going to get. If I go to this place, here's how the money that I provide to that school is going to be allocated and used. And I think that makes sense for me. And so they can make a more informed, better decision. That's the aim of the transparency provisions in H.R. 1911. And it's been, you know, frankly, heartening to see that we've had lots of bipartisan support for that part of the bill.
Yeah. But I understand it's a little bit contentious with the other parts. For example, what is the cost of actually subsidizing these federal student loans? Like, is it costing us right now to keep them at about 3.8%?
So to extend the current rate of 3.4%.
Oh, excuse me, 3.4%.
Yeah, yes, sir. For another year would cost about $4.5 billion. $4.6 billion is how it was scored by the Congressional Budget Office. And our legislation actually has lower interest rates in the short term, so it costs a little bit more than that. But over time, we think it begins to reflect true market conditions. And so, and that's important not to, to understate. Those market conditions, interest rates, are also reflective of what's going on in the economy. So if inflation is higher and the interest rates are a little bit higher, it ought to be the case that salaries and job opportunities similarly would comport with that. So we try and account for changes in economic conditions here and what the students will find when they use these resources for what for the thing they intended, to go out into the world and do it, what it is they want to do with the degree that they achieve.
Should the government even be in the business of providing these loans?
Look, in the first instance, I think these kinds of loans can be made other places better. If I were writing this myself, I would not have the federal government in the business of making these loans directly. That was a decision that the president made, President Obama made when he came into office, and that's where we are. We don't try and undo that here as part of this legislation. But you have to also remember, too, we're focused on student loans in this conversation today. There are many, many other programs, local, state programs, scholarship programs that universities and colleges offer themselves that afford monies for students to go to college. There are Pell Grant programs, which are used by lots of kids going to school as well. They are largely needs-based awards of grants, federal grant money. And there's many, many at the state and local level, both in Kansas and Missouri as well. Mm-hmm. So this student loan issue is only a part of the student financing puzzle.
Congressman Mike Pompeo from Kansas's 4th District, thank you so much for joining us today on Central Standard.
Matt, thank you so much. Have a great day.
That was Mike Pompeo, Republican of Kansas, speaking with Central Standard producer Matthew Long Middleton yesterday. This is Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. We're joined now from Washington by Emmanuel Cleaver II. He represents Missouri's 5th District, including much of Kansas City. Congressman, welcome to Central Standard.
Good to be with you.
So you voted against H.R. 1911 that we just heard Republican Mike Pompeo talking about and about why he supported it. Why did you vote against it?
Well, I voted against it with a great deal of pride, and I'm very pleased to say that I voted against it, because it makes the situation even worse for students rather than helping keep college affordable. The bill, H.R. 1911, exacerbates student debt by changing higher interest rates, as my colleague, Mr. Pompeo, said, over time. I think instead of putting more debt on students in the future, we need to deal with this problem in a very comprehensive manner and make sure that in the future we are still able to compete with other nations in terms of the people instead of the students who are able to go through our great colleges and universities.
Now, on its surface, Congressman Cleaver, it would appear that the bill that the House Republicans passed would, in fact, lower the costs. Why do you say that this would increase the costs?
Well, it does lower the cost or keep the rates low initially. But my colleagues made a statement earlier. I think he said something like, in the short term, it reduces rates. He's absolutely right. But that's also the problem with Washington. We do everything in the short term. We're not thinking about future generations. And I simply think that that's one of the least intelligent things that we're doing in Washington. And so instead of trying to make a comprehensive legislation that would address not only my children, but my grandchildren and maybe even their children, we're doing something that only deals with the immediate, at least in terms of the short term. But keep in mind that the bill that I voted against, H.R. 1911, will raise the rates over time to a point where it will cost, in terms of the interest rate, our students up to $2,000 more a year when they're repaying it. And one of every 10 graduates owe more than $54,000. How in the world are you going to get started out of college with that kind of debt?
Now, you talk about the need for comprehensive reform or a longer-term sort of reform. Your colleagues across the Capitol at the Senate Democrats, have been calling to simply extend the current 3.4% rate for another 2 years. The White House says it would like to see something that is, in fact, tied to market rates, but different than what the House Republicans have proposed. What is it that you'd like to see happen?
Well, first of all, I think we cannot get into into dictating to colleges and universities how much tuition rises. However, with the Pell Grants and the Stafford Loans as leverage, I think we can say to colleges and universities, if your tuition rises above a certain point, then we reduce the number of Pell Grants and Stafford Loans that your university can get. And so by that, we do place some limits on colleges and universities. Now, the students would still have access to colleges that did not raise the tuition. So I think that's the long-term kind of thinking that I think we should be doing. But at the same time, keep in mind that the GOP plan reset rates on student loans every year based on 10-year Treasury notes with another, I think it's 2.5 percent points added on.
Right.
And future rates would be capped. Now, I support capping the rates, but I don't support allowing these student loan interest rates to rise based on Treasury notes. I think that's very dangerous because students can take out a loan and not have any idea what the rate will be by the time they graduate.
So the president's proposal then is to allow the rate to rise in connection with the prevailing market rate, but locking in the rate to the life of the life of the loan.
That's right. I got to tell you, I mean, those of us in the House, many of us in the House, I mean, we support most of what the president recommends in his proposal. The president, just for the listeners' point of view, understand that cannot introduce legislation.
Right.
The president can simply send over to us his views on legislation. And we disagree with the president on some aspects of that, in terms of allowing the market rates to take over. But we do agree with the president that the rates would remain low presently, and we agree with the president obviously on the cap. But we cannot allow these students to have steadily mounting debt. And then expect them to come out into a workforce that, frankly, is not as healthy as it should be, trying to get a job, many of whom are only going to get part-time jobs, and then have to pay part of their debt. But right now, and this is a crisis I don't think people are aware of, I mean, we have a staggering $1.1 trillion in student debt, student loans, and a large percentage of it, of those loans, are already in default. So why in the world would the Congress of the United States make matters worse for its students?
So the Senate Democrats, at least, are voting this week on a bill that, instead of tying the rate to prevailing market rates, would lock in the current 3.4%. Should at least for the next couple of years. Should that pass the Senate and come make its way back over to the House, would you support that bill?
Well, what would happen is that we hopefully have a conference committee that would struggle with trying to get those two bills harmonized. Excuse me, I'm struggling with a cold.
Yeah, sounds like you have a cold, Congressman.
And hopefully the bill would come over a little more acceptable. Now, nobody gets his or her way, so I am always open to compromise, but I believe strongly that we must think long term.
I want to invite our listeners, if they have a question for the Congressman, Emanuel Cleaver, about H.R. 1911 or about other legislative proposals on student loans, you can give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, I wanted to ask about another aspect of the bill that you voted against last week. You heard Congressman Pompeo discussing transparency about how money is spent, how this the grants and loans that go to colleges and universities are used. Do you have a problem with that study aspect that this bill calls for?
Absolutely not. But keep in mind that quite often the word study is put into legislation to try to convince the voters that something intelligent is being done, and I can almost assure you that whatever study he's talking about is something that most of the people listening to this show right now will never see or hear about. Most of the state schools are already transparent. I mean, the University of Missouri information about how money is spent is already available to you, to anybody who wants it. And we have a board of curators appointed by the governor. So we do have control over the system. The problem is the steadily rising tuition rate. That's the problem. And until we are willing to address that, this problem is not only going to continue, it will be exacerbated.
You know, it makes me wonder about something else that Congressman Pompeo said that I wonder if you would what your take on it would be. He said that the goal of H.R. 1911 is to, quote, get the political process out of setting these rates. Is it really possible to get the political process out of the student loan debate?
Well, I think no, to be quite candid. No, that's not going to happen anytime soon. In 2007, I think it was, we gradually reduced the rates. But it was an election year, so the 3.4 was extended. So we control the interest rates, and I think in this is one of those cases where I think the government being involved in student loans is important in the sense that we, the people who are elected, are in control of the interest rates, and that we should not be about the business of raising the interest rates to make money. And one of the problems now is, which was not stated in the interview, is that many of the people on the other side, who are good and decent people, many of whom I like a lot, but they believe that everyone should be involved in deficit reduction. And so when you look at the fact that I think we made $50 billion off student loans, to me that's obscene.
Right.
One of the reasons for government involvement is that we shouldn't be about the business of trying to make a profit like a bank if they were making student loans. I mean, no bank, and this is not to badmouth banks, but no bank is going to make a student loan to try to break even in order to get kids college degrees. That's not what they're in business for. So there is a legitimate role for the government.
So where would you pay for this? No matter what plan is adopted, it's probably going to cost something, right? Where do you make the cut, or is this worth extending the deficit for?
Well, I don't think we put our children in deficit reduction. I think that's something that is short sighted. I think we do pay for the student loans, but and there are a lot of ways of doing it. For example, we subsidize big oil by $4 billion a year. And ExxonMobil and Shell earned a whopping $30.2 billion during the first quarter of this year. $30.2 billion in profits, not revenue, but profits. And one-third of the profits were used to repurchase company stock, which means that it helps their executives. So we have $4 billion that we're giving to big oil. I mean, that is just not in any way the kind of government that I think people believe they have. And so we can subsidize these Stafford loans by making common sense reductions in some of the other spending. And I would start right out with big oil, $30.2 billion during the first quarter of this year. That's just ExxonMobil and Shell.
And, in fact, we'll be talking about ExxonMobil in the next hour on Up to Date with Steve Kraske. Congressman Cleaver, do you have time for one question from a constituent here?
Sure.
Okay, great. Let's talk to Waylon in Kansas City, Missouri. Waylon, welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks for having me on. Quick question for you, Cleaver. I wanted to find out what your view is on the continuous subsidization of the banks, the people who are giving these loans, and their ability to turn that into profit. I'm wondering if perhaps the focus should be more on the student loans themselves, trying to get those down to a lower zero-interest loan, rather than giving the banks a zero-interest loan to turn around and charge us on that.
Thanks, Waylon, for the question.
Well, he actually answered his own question, because I was just saying earlier, yes, absolutely, the government can be more involved in it and to reduce the overhead of loans, because these loans would go directly to the colleges and universities. And so we would then avoid going through financial institutions. Let me just add quickly, during the downturn in the economy, the Great Recession, many people who were saving money through banks for their college-bound students in the future lost money. Mm. And so they were saving money, and if their kid graduated sometime during the Great Recession, or maybe 2 years ago or last year, they actually didn't have enough money. So there's a danger in going through the banks.
Well, I'm sure we haven't heard the last of this conversation. Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, Democrat from Kansas City, thank you so much for taking so much time with us on a busy day.
Good to be with you.
When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about student loans and paying for college with a practical turn. We have experts on financial aid, saving and investing, and financial planning, and we hope we'll have your questions too. If you're thinking about sending a kid off to school, or you are that kid who's now a grown-up trying to pay for it, call us at 816-235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Regardless of what Congress does about the interest rates on subsidized student loans, it won't address the reality that college still costs a lot, and borrowing enough to pay for it at any rate, even if it were possible, still saddles students with a burden that they carry well into their adult life. Many see this as a problem for the whole country. I know that at the very least, it is a problem for many families here in the Kansas City area, maybe even you. So to talk with us about that are experts with a variety of backgrounds. Mel Tyler is Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs and Enrollment Management here at UMKC. Welcome to you, Mel.
Thank you.
Stacy Belford is Vice President for 529 Plans at American Century Investments. And welcome to you, Stacy.
Good morning. Thanks.
We're also joined by Bob Anthony. He's a financial advisor with Ameriprise Investments here in Kansas City. Welcome, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
We do want our listeners to be part of the conversation, too. How are you paying for college? And how did you save? Was it enough? Share your ideas and your questions at 235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Mel Tyler, let's start on the financial aid side. We talked in that first half hour about the federally subsidized student loans, the Stafford loans. How important are those for students at a university like UMKC?
Well, they're extremely important for students to supplement their their education and invest in their future. I do also think that students should be looking at college and university scholarship programs. Those programs are usually centered around three areas. One is merit-based, the other is need-based, and then most colleges and universities do have endowed scholarship programs where they've raised funds from outside to support students in their education.
Well, let's talk a little bit about these different kinds of scholarships that are available, because obviously I think a lot of parents hope for many years that their kids are going to play football well enough or score perfect scores on their SAT and get these scholarships. How much of that kind of money is available? How many students are getting that kind of merit-based scholarship?
Well, most universities or colleges do have merit-based programs. I think the key to these are to, number one, put yourself in a position to qualify for those positions, and that really starts early on in your high school career. But also understanding the rules and around those particular programs. At UMKC, our merit programs are renewable, and they're renewable up to 5 years if students maintain a certain grade point average. There's a lot of colleges and universities that front-load these programs where they will provide you with a scholarship the first year, and then after the first year, those scholarships go away. So it's real important as you're looking at an institution to really understand the scholarship program and whether or not it's renewable or not.
I have to ask you, Mel Tyler, you know, we heard both of the congressmen that we had on the program today talk about the rising prices of higher education. Congress Pompeo talked about how the costs are outpacing inflation. Congressman Cleaver even proposes reducing the federal grants and loans to colleges if they don't keep tuition down. What's your reaction about that? Why are costs rising so much?
Well, there's basically the cost of attendance and the cost of instruction. Really increased along with other things that increased throughout the country. When colleges are looking at their budgets for the year, they figure in the cost of instruction. We figure in the amount of aid that's available for students and how to support these students to be successful throughout the course of their career.
Yeah, I guess I'm my curiosity is about these merit-based and need-based scholarships and I know you're most familiar with UMKC, obviously, but just in general, it seems like maybe there's not enough of that scholarship money available to go around to keep students from, in many cases, going, as we heard, very deeply into debt.
Well, I think when most universities are setting budgets, you know, for UMKC, our discount rate is right at about 30%, and that's right at the national average. And that's where those types of funds are located. And when you're setting a university-wide budget, you want to budget in that type of funds, but also leverage the other types of funds that I've spoken of also. Those endowed funds are really good funds to leverage to be able to help students at a whole different level past the merit scholarship program.
Well, I want to talk more about some of those other sources of funding that are available, but let me bring Stacy Bedford into the conversation. All this talk about student loans in our first half today, it makes us wonder if maybe we should talk less about taking out loans and about ways that your student can be preparing in other ways. What are some of the options out there, especially if maybe you're not making an all-star soccer player or an 800 SAT type of student?
And well, there certainly are other options, and we really promote the idea of saving and planning ahead versus just planning on taking loans. So if you look at taking out a $100,000 loan that you're going to pay at a rate of, let's say, 7% over 10 years, you're going to pay $40,000 in interest on that loan. So it's going to cost you $140,000 to get a $100,000 loan. Meanwhile, if you just saved $232 a month for 18 years and you earned 7% on that savings, it would only cost you a little over $50,000 to have that same $100,000. eligible.
7% is a pretty pretty optimistic earning rate, isn't it?
Well, it is. It is. But, you know, I think you can run those numbers any number of way. But we really look at, you know, families who have a plan and to save for college are more likely to reach a goal and actually have money toward it. I mean, the reality is most families are going to pay for college with a combination of savings, current income, and financial aid packages or loans. So, you know, we just feel that every dollar that you put away in savings ahead of time is a dollar you're not going to pay interest on down the road.
We heard Congressman Cleaver cite a statistic that 1 in 10 students graduate with a debt of more than $54,000. Is that, besides that number, what's the average student loan debt?
It depends a little bit on the source. There have been different studies, but in general, the average debt has doubled in the last 10 years and is anywhere from $20,000 to $25,000.
Right. So what's the impact of graduating with that kind of debt? I mean, how heavy a burden is that in a person who's starting out their career?
Well, it's a huge burden. If you come out of college and with a $25,000 debt, you are less likely to start saving for retirement. You're less likely to purchase a home, purchase an automobile, and you may even be willing to put off medical or dental expenses because you simply feel that you can't afford them. So there's that impact to the individual. And then, you know, you can take a look at what's the impact then to the overall economy if these college graduates are not buying homes and buying cars.
So one of the areas that you work in fact, the primary area you work in over at American Century is with 529 plans. What is a 529 plan?
A 529 college savings plan is a tax advantaged way to save for college. So you simply contribute after-tax dollars. Those dollars grow tax-deferred and are tax-free upon withdrawal as long as you use them for qualified higher education expenses. And that can be at a traditional four-year public or private institution, but it can also be at a two-year college or at a vocational technical school.
And is there any limit on how much you can save through a plan like this?
Sure. Every plan has their own limits. These plans are administered by the states, and every state has a 529 plan of some sort. In Kansas, the plan that we manage for the state of Kansas is LearningQuest, and the contribution limit on that is $335,000. Now, your account could continue to grow after that amount, but you can't contribute additional dollars. Although I will tell you, nationally, the average account balance in a 529 plan is $17,000. So the plans are flexible from that standpoint, but we're not seeing people put in anywhere near as much as what they're really going to need to cover the cost of college.
Now, one of the things that I've heard, and either Mel Tyler or Stacey Belford, you can address this. I have heard that if you have a lot of savings for college, you're going to be less eligible for the need-based financial assistance. And so some parents sort of look at the numbers and think, well, maybe I shouldn't, in fact, save so much because I'm only going to end up accumulating money that is then taken away, which I would have had access to more scholarship aid if I hadn't saved so much. How do you respond to that? Is that really a true assessment, Mel Tyler?
Well, it does help, but I don't see any families anymore that are receiving enough federal financial aid to be able to support their entire education. Mm-hmm. So really having as much funds available to support that education is really important, whether it's through savings, whether it's through scholarship opportunities and federal aid.
I suppose some of this depends on whether the parents want to be the ones burdened with the cost or the student just at the very beginning of their career.
Right. One of the benefits of a 529 plan is that if the parent is the account owner, only 5.6% of those assets in that 529 plan are counted toward financial aid when you're filling out that FAFSA. So it's really a very small percent that is counted toward that. And I just would really encourage people to not let that stand in the way of putting that money aside. If the 529 account is in the child's name, they count a higher percent of that income. And I would add that grandparents can also own 529 plans for their grandchildren, and none of those assets are counted as income when you're filling out the FAFSA, although they might count as income when you take the distribution.
Right. And for those who do not have students in the 2 years before college starts, what does FAFSA stand for?
Help me out here, Mel.
Okay, well, everyone who works with them daily can't remember what it stands for, I suppose. It's the Financial Aid Form for Student Assistance or something like that?
It's the Federal Assistance
We'll send an intern to work
good
on
question.
This. Don't worry about it. Bob Anthony from Ameriprise, there are other investment options out there besides 529 plans. What are some other ways that a family that's trying to think ahead to college, what are some other things they may want to be thinking about right now?
Well, of course, as Kathy mentioned, there's lots of ways to fund college.
Stacy.
Lots of ways to fund a college education, and these issues are similar to any type of financial planning. The fact is most people don't take enough time. They say that no one plans to fail, but many people fail to plan. And this is just another issue where there's a goal in mind and some time ahead of you in order to reach that goal. The basics are the same, seriously, depending on what your goals are, but college education is merely just another goal. That needs to be funded. There are lots of different sources. Nobody today has mentioned working. I worked when I went to school, and I spent summers working, and I also part-time worked while I was in school, and I noticed that nobody talks about this. This is a good source of income. Financial education begins, again, I think it was Mel had said that when in reference to scholarships, that this stuff begins early on in your high school career. I would say that these things begin even previous to your high school career. Financial education can start with people when they're very young, and having the ability to save. And what we're really talking about is making good decisions and good choices. But the more information and education that we have, of course, we're better off to make those good choices. If we understand what we're getting involved in up front, then we can make different choices.
We had a Twitter post from Amy. She said kids need to be educated on what debt they are getting into, and that's something that you're saying, Bob. How do you educate kids about that?
Well, that's a good question. You educate kids the same way you educate adults, and the fact is we learn the difference between needs and wants. And everyone, and I don't care who you are, everyone has a limited amount of resources available. And we all must make difficult choices during our life cycles, be it whether we're planning for college education or we're planning for retirement. There's always difficult decisions that need to be made, and we can't continue to avoid the D word, and that's discipline. And this is it's very hard to execute, simple to understand.
816-235-2888 is the number to call if you have questions about paying for college, saving for college, getting student loans, and paying them off afterward. 816-235-2888. Let's talk to Trish in Merriam. Trish, thanks for holding with us. Welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning. I have a couple of comments. First, I work in higher education. I've been in college admissions for over a decade. I've worked for private and public universities. And I'm very concerned about some advice that your experts have given. While I think that scholarships are a great opportunity, as well, of course, federal financial aid as methods and means in which to pay for tuition and related college expenses, those aren't sufficient avenues in which to pay for your education.
What would you
suggest?
Limited.
I suggest that when students are sophomores, the last semester of their sophomore year, that they start really considering and looking at private scholarship sources. The government and
give
public
us some
universities
examples
as well.
Of that.
There's plenty. There's scholarships.com. FinAid.org is a great website in which to utilize a resource. FastWeb.com.
Okay.
These are all search engines which will then forward scholarships in which you are suitable for.
Sure. Okay, Trish, I appreciate that call. Let me ask Mel Tyler. Do you agree students should find other financial aid sources outside of the college they're attending?
100%. That was really my next point. I have three areas that are websites that students can go to look at outside scholarships. I think the FastWeb.com scholarship website is one. CollegeBoard.com is another, and then the CollegeNet website. Those are really excellent websites that list national scholarships for students to look into.
And we'll get all of those links from Mel here after the show and get them up online at kcur.org. And you can follow the links to the Central Standard page, and we'll get those links up so you can see them there. Stacy Belford, we were talking about the 529 plans. I guess I'm wondering what other sort of savings options there might might be. Is there anything less complicated? Is there something that is as simple? I mean, does it just make sense to start a savings account, or are there tax problems with doing something like that?
I think that the 529 plan, and obviously I'm going to be biased toward that, but it is one of the few vehicles where you get the flexibility and the tax deferral. So certainly you can do a savings account. Some people use CDs. Some people use IRAs UGMA UTMAs and Coverdales, and there are a number of other plans, and there are pros and cons to each of those. Some people prefer the Coverdales because you can use those for K-12 expenses. You cannot use a 529 plan for that. I would just stress, kind of back to what Bob said, is you need to start early. You need to have a plan. If you think it's too complicated to put a plan together, consult with a financial advisor. But start saving early some vehicle that you are comfortable with.
Bob, Anthony, you have talked about people needing to have goals to know what their plan is, and Stacy's talked about that as well. How do you determine goals when you don't know what the educational costs are going to be in 18 years or 5 years or even 2 years?
Well, that's also a good question. And again, you could say the same thing about retirement planning. If you're looking at a 30 or 40 year picture, we have to make certain assumptions on inflation and cost in order to set those goals. And of course, every individual's needs are different, and their situations are all different too.
Sure. Where do you even start? Let's say a family comes to you, makes an appointment, says we want to plan for college. What's the first thing you're going to talk about with them?
Well, we talk about savings, and we talk about discipline, and we talk about – a lot of times I talk about buckets. Different goals require setting monies aside. One of the reasons the 529 plan appeals to me is it forces you to set monies aside. These are designated for nothing but college, and you can't change your mind halfway through the game and say, well, an emergency arose, and we need to dip into this or we need to dip into that, which gets me back to the D word. It does force the level of discipline that's required. There are software programs available that can help you to extrapolate college costs in the future and how much you need to save today to get there.
I wonder, Mel Tyler, all this talk about how expensive college is, is it worth it? And I don't mean that in a flippant way. I mean, these rising costs, it ends up being hundreds of thousands of dollars for some students. Obviously, UMKC is not the most expensive college out there, but some pay considerably more. What is the value of a college education today, and why is it worth risking this debt?
Well, it really is an investment in your future. And this year, I think 60% of the potential work out there requires a college education. We know that employers that are looking for within their companies, they're looking for workers is more related to their education background than students that don't have a college degree. Their ability to be lifelong learners and grow within the companies all come with the opportunities that are presented with the college education.
If I could just
Please, excuse me, if
I could just add to that, it's also not only do people who have higher education earn more over their lifetime, they're actually more likely to have a job too, which is something that's been really relevant the last few years. If you look at the unemployment rate of over 10% back in 2010, it wasn't 10% across all education levels. That rate was over almost 15% for people who didn't even have a high school diploma. But you get down to people who had some college, even an associate's degree, the unemployment level was only 7%. And if you had a four-year degree, the unemployment level was 5.4%. So you're more likely to have a job and hang on to a job and earn more, in addition to earning more over your lifetime.
So there's a sense in which going to college is very much an investment, and not just in a metaphorical way, but financially it's an investment.
Absolutely.
We have an email from a listener who asks a question about 529s. Says, if your kid doesn't go to college, it becomes taxable income. Is that correct? Are there other options available that for where you wouldn't be taking that risk?
Well, the only way to really recognize the tax benefits is to use the dollars for qualified higher education expenses. But if your child does not go to college, you have two options. You can either change the beneficiary on the account to another child, another relative. You can use the funds yourself. You could be the beneficiary and go back to school, or you can take those dollars out, but you are going to pay a penalty and you're going to pay tax on the earnings.
I see. So, but any student could use the money that's put in this 529, a child, a grandchild, a niece, a nephew.
That's right. You simply change the beneficiary on the account.
Let's take one more call from Stephanie in Kansas City, Missouri. Stephanie, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, I just wanted to point out that if your kid takes AP classes and takes college credit classes, and then when my son was in high school, I made him, instead of get a job working, I made him take classes at the community college because I told him that will save me more money, you getting college credit now, than me paying. And what happened is he started KU as his, he was 18 and started KU as a junior because he had 2 years of college credit under his belt, so that saved me 2 years of paying for college.
So it sounds like a winning choice for mom. Is he happy with his choice, Stephanie?
Yeah, he was. He was. And he was smart. He based, knowing his college, his AP classes and what classes he'd taken at JUCO, he based colleges on where they would accept those transfer credits because some colleges wouldn't take the JUCO credits. And, yeah, so that saved me 2 years of paying for college, which totally got the pressure off.
Stephanie,
the whole family.
Thank you so much for that tip. Stacy, I saw you nodding your head. That's a good plan.
Community colleges are a tremendous value. And again, going back to what Bob said earlier, don't just start saving early. Start talking to your kids early about what you can truly afford and how much you're willing to pay for their college. And community college can be a great way to get those early credits taken care of.
And Mel Tyler, UMKC is a school that would take some of those credits from community colleges too, right?
Absolutely. We have a really extensive articulation agreements with all of the area community colleges.
Well, we wish we could talk a little more about this. There's plenty more questions, but you can follow the links that we'll put up on our website, kcur.org. Go to the Central Standard page, and you can check out some of the information our guests have shared today. Mel Tyler is Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs at UMKC, Stacy Belford, Vice President for 529 Plans at American Century, and Bob Anthony, Financial Advisor with Ameriprise. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You can subscribe to our podcast, or hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows on the Central Standard page of kcur.org. Join us tomorrow when we get a close-up look at the bloodsuckers of summer. I'm not talking about any members of Congress. I'm not. Ticks is what I'm talking about. We'll also look at the world's most used psychotropic drug, caffeine. Uh-oh. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Suzanne Hogan, with help today from Claire McInerney, Ross Steinmetz, and Sangeeta Shastri. Our announcer is Kim Noble. Up to Date is next with a look at America's biggest private corporation and the Kansas City Royals. Two different things. I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR.